Well, good morning, everybody. I'm going to speak complete nonsense while the volume levels come up to an appropriate level, and then I'm going to continue as I began. All right. We've on the reverse side of Touchstone is an introduction to the Psalms, and also Psalm 1 for our Bible studies as well, and it covers a range of the different kinds of materials, different types of poetry, the different kinds of themes covered in the Psalms. There are songs of praise, songs of lament, thanksgiving psalms, songs of trust and confidence, kingship psalms, and wisdom psalms. And you'll find helpful just looking through some of those psalms to get the breadth of what is in this collection of 150 different prayers, praises, and reflections in there. Now, that list is not particularly exhaustive or complete. It omits what I call the revenge psalms, you know, which where David says, "Lord, smash my enemy's teeth in," psalms. And we might look at why that psalm is in there and what God does with it later on in the New Testament particularly. But they're called precatory psalms in the technical language, but I call them revenge psalms. But the list itself can be described in other ways. I've put them in that way because it identifies with our human experience. And indeed, the psalms are simply that. They're songs and prayers and praises that are born out of the personal encounter with this living God. And Psalm 1 is quite unusual in this collection of psalms because it's not like the style of those other psalms. Psalm 1 would be described as a wisdom psalm. A wisdom material is essentially material that helps people to think about how to live the good life, how to live a life that is truly enjoyable, truly fulfilling, and truly life-enhancing. And really, that kind of material of wisdom is more reflective of the Proverbs. And the Proverbs are full of materials about how to live the good life and avoid the bad life, as it were. Why is it there, then? Well, it's there simply as a doorway, a gateway into this material as a whole. The compiler who finally put the collection of psalms together chose this psalm and may well have written it specifically as a front piece to the collection itself. So, true happiness. And that's taken from this phrase, "Blessed is a person who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly." Now, I'm being a bit cheeky there because the word blessed doesn't mean simply happy. Not that the Bible's got anything against happiness. It does value the gift that God gives us, which lifts us to enjoy life and find it pleasurable. That's why chocolate is good. It is one of those things that makes us enjoy something of the goodness of God, the fruitfulness of God's creation. Very similar word to the word happy in the Bible is the word joy. It's a kind of deeper word. It's a word that kind of draws us to what God wants for all human beings, an experience of true bliss. I think it was C.S. Lewis, wasn't it? When he was a young boy, had this occasion as a young, maybe a 10 or 11-year-old, experienced a moment of complete and utter joy, as he called it, bliss. It was a passing moment. He thought it was the beginning of his life as a person, but actually it was just a fleeting thing. And he spent a good rest of his teenage and young adult years looking for that joy again. And it's reflected in his autobiography, spiritual autobiography, called Surprised by Joy. Another related word to this is the word bliss, and it's another deeper word again. Bliss is really the word of heaven. It's that complete and utter joy that people will experience in the presence of God himself, or in the presence of his new creation, where everything is as it should be. everything works well. Everything is fruitful and wonderful. And so we enjoy the responsibilities of being in that new creation, but we don't endure the stress of it. And that's a lovely thought, isn't it? The joy of something that has no stress within it. So I've just covered several words there related to happiness, which really point us to something deeper and deeper and deeper again and again. And that's what happiness is meant to do. It's not meant to be an end in itself. It's meant to be a pointer within the human soul to somewhere and someone else. So when the psalmist used the word blessed, he's speaking about something more broader and more enhancing than that simple experience of happiness. Although happiness is something that people want for themselves and for others. Survey after survey, and if I ask people, what do you really want for your children? They will often say, I want my children to be happy. It's quite amazing how in our culture that has been the consistent response for many, many decades. Apparently Americans believe they have a divine right to this, the pursuit of this, and the enjoyment of this. To be blessed is to enjoy the favour and the kindness of God. It's linked to the idea of appreciating his kindness and enjoying his life to the full. And as I talk for a few minutes, I don't know why preachers say that really, because it's never true, isn't it? As I talk, I'm going to read some of those psalms to you just to illustrate the breadth of what the psalmist is talking about. This idea of the favour of God and being experiencing that favour of God, Psalm 103, which I think David is going to be speaking on in a few weeks' time, tells us several reasons to be happy. The psalmist says, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all my inmost being, praise his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. And then he gives out several reasons why he should be happy and why the person he's talking to should be happy. He who forgives all your sins, he who heals all your diseases, he who redeems your life from the pit, he who crowns you with love and compassion, who satisfies your desires with good things so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. These are reasons to be blessed, to be happy. All of those things, the encounter of God. Linked to this idea is a person who is content. Content with who they are and content with what they have. Now those two things as a juggling operation are not easy in the human experience. Being happy with who we are and being happy with what we have. Paul could say, I know and I have learned to be content or happy, whatever in the circumstance I face. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to be in plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in every and all situations. Whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Now, that's a challenge, isn't it? It's suggesting that happiness isn't mainly or only experiential. It's saying that contentment isn't simply circumstantial, that it's something to do with deeper than the experience of the human person. This idea of discontentment is a source of drive which seeks people seeking happiness as an end in and of itself. That drive to discontent, driving people to seeking happiness in and of itself. We're going to watch a film clip now. Will Smith is a character called Chris Gardner, and he appears in a film called The Pursuit of Happiness. And so I'm just going to ask the curtains to be closed, the spotlights to be turned off. And I want you just to ask yourself, what does Chris Gardner, Will Smith, lose in the pursuit of happiness? And there is sound with this. Thanks, Rich. There will be questions.
Man, I got two questions for you.
Tell what it do up, you Tom,
do and how do you do it?
Hey!
This part of my life.
Wait!
This part here. It's called running.
You want something? Go get it. Period.
Well, can be ordered off Amazon tonight. And delivered to your home within 4 working days. The pursuit of happiness. So what did he nearly lose in making happiness his full goal? The pursuit itself, an end in itself. What kind of things did he nearly lose because of those things? Nearly lost his family, that's right. Lost his wife, yes?
What?
Lost his temper. That's right. That's right. Lost his temper. Rank. The school run. It's a killer, isn't it? Yes. What else did he lose?
He tried to run away.
He did a lot of running. That's right, Edward. Yes.
He nearly lost his life.
He nearly lost his life. That's right. He got run over because he was rushing off to... He lost his patience. That's right. Lost his patience. That's right. Yes. You're a good moral lot, aren't you? Not none of you have mentioned he lost his flipping car, you know. What he did lose, and I was very impressed when Karen did this thing about what makes you happy, because many of the answers were relational answers. Many of the answers that you said that make you happy were to do with those people you love and those people you know. And that's why Karen's example of the photograph with the different generations together is a very powerful illustration of what happiness can be about. It's really a byproduct of something else. It's always a byproduct of relationship, never a byproduct of simply of things. So the key theme of that film is really this man, he loses his wife, one relationship gone because of his endless pursuit of happiness or success, as it turned about. He nearly loses his son, you know. Get on the bus or under the bus, I don't know, you know. But, I mean, if he carried on that very long, he would have lost his relationship with his son. And in a sense, he begins to lose himself, doesn't he? He starts off with a very firm view of himself in the film as being a good parent, a good dad. But as he goes through the experience, all of that becomes disintegrated. He loses his temper and he loses his patience with people. All of those things which are around us all the time, every day of our lives, like oxygen, people, right? For God, are the most important thing about happiness. Are they to do with how we enjoy happiness and live in it? And so this psalm tells us the greatest thing you could lose is the most important relationship you could have. And that would be the relationship with the one who made you, who knows how you work, and knows how you can work well. So he suggests two ways of thinking about that loss and that life. And so, Richard, I wonder if you could put back up on the screen verses 1 to 3 of Psalm 1 for me, just to read that. It says, "Blessed is the man and woman who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in season. Its leaf does not wither. Whatever he does, he prospers." So the first contrast he brings out, and it's a powerful contrast, is between those who know that relationship with God and those who do not know that relationship with God. And those who do not enjoy that favour, that kindness of God, which brings true blessedness, true favour, true happiness, he suggests that there are three level slide into loss of relationship. He talks about those who walk, those who stand, and those who sit. And it's up on that verse there. Those who walk in the counsel of the wicked, those who stand in the way of sinners, and those who sit in the seat of mockers. It's suggesting that people take up life positions that gradually draw them away from God and into that which essentially takes away their source of blessedness. Walking, standing, and sitting. I want you to imagine I'm walking in a city, could be any city, down a flight of a row of shops, I'm just enjoying the sun and the scenery, and when one shop window catches my eye, I look at that shop window and I stare into it as I'm stood there looking into it, I'm drooling at the pictures that I see and thinking, yes, I would like that. I then not only walk, not only stand, but I go in and sit and wait for my short backs and sides haircut, because that is what I need most of all. So you get the idea of the motion, don't you, really? But imagine if I was somewhere where I know not to be. Imagine if I was in a red light district. And as I'm walking down that red light district, I see people in the windows that offer their services. I am where I shouldn't be. I'm walking. I stand and I look into the window, what I should be looking at. And then I go in and spend time and I sit with somebody who is not my wife, who I do not love, who I do not know. You can see the progression in the psalmist's words here. That, he says, will destroy your relationship and destroy your source of true happiness. And it will destroy your relationship with God. It suggests the way of the blessed is completely different. And he suggests the way of the blessed or the happy are to do with their desires and to do with their focus. To do with their desires and their focus. Because we said earlier on that happiness is a deep-rooted desire that gets us to look for other things. It's not meant to be an end in itself. How does this person retrain their happiness, their desire, their pleasure principle? Let's use that word, I suppose. How do they retrain their pleasure principle so they don't see it as an end in itself, but they see it as a goal to something else? Well, he says, quite simply, this person delights in God's law. He looks somewhere else. And she looks at the focus of that law is to meditate on that law day and night. The blessed life is found in God's way, he says, and she says, not as a restraining thing, but as a liberating thing. As a look at the word of God to see it is not as life denying, but as life enhancing. In the New Testament, by the time the gospel writers come along, the law really has a very, very, very bad reputation. It's seen as something that is so overwhelmingly burdensome. And yet, when the psalmist, particularly the psalmist, write about it in Psalm 19, he's rhapsodizing about the great gift that God has given us in The law of the Lord. The law of the Lord is perfect. It refreshes my soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy. It makes wise those who are simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure. It endures forever. This is a good thing, a good gift that God has given his people. It's almost as if when Moses was at the foot of the mountain when the Ten Commandments were given, God was bringing Israel himself as his bride, and he was marrying the bride, and he gave the bride a wonderful wedding present, and that was his gift of his law. Something that would give them order, something that would give them direction, something that would give them purpose, something that would give them joy. So when you ever find religious people on the internet, in preaching, and in this church, using the law in such a way as to dehumanize people, restrict people, kill people off, then you know it's not a right use of God's law. Because that law is meant to lead people to become human and fulfilled and making them whole. The law are more precious than gold, more than much pure gold. It is sweeter than honey, more than honey from the honeycomb. Because by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them your servant has great reward. In verse 4, 5 and 6, it says, Blessed are like a tree that is planted by streams of water. It yields its fruit in season. Its leaf does not wither. Nor does he, whatever he does, he prospers. Verse 4 says, Not so the wicked. They are like chaff, and the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the day of judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the unrighteous. These two ways are presented in a very idealized way. It's done in that way in order to present the power of the contrast of their ultimate destiny rather than their present experience. Because the psalmist knows, and the person who writes this psalm as a front piece to the rest of the psalm, he knows, and he's going to tell you from experience, that the righteous sometimes don't succeed, that the good sometimes suffer. And they sometimes find their life hard. And sometimes, if you read Psalm 37, they find themselves envying the prosperity of the unrighteous. And the psalmist knows full well that the righteous sometimes, unrighteous sometimes succeed, often are prosperous. But their ultimate contrast is found in their end. The psalmist in Psalm 73 says, Surely in vain I've kept myself pure, and I've washed my hands in innocence for no good reason. All day long I have been afflicted, and every morning brings new hardships. But if I had spoken out like this, I would have betrayed your people. When I tried to understand this, all of it seemed deeply troubling. The fact that he was living a good life and not being successful, and seeing the ungodly being successful and not living a good life, this really distressed the psalmist. But it says in verse 73, verse 17, When I tried to understand this, I was deeply troubled till I entered into the presence of the sanctuary of God, and then I understood their final destiny. That's what it says at the end of this psalm. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. The fruitfulness of the life of God in the believer will never die. All the things that we do in our lives continue, if they're born of God, to live forever. And the Apostle Paul says there are three things that will endure on faith, hope, and love. And your relationships and how you relate to each other and how you relate to God and know him is a thing that you will build with in the life to come. That will truly endure. the psalm tells me at the end that God watches over you who live that way. Psalm 1 isn't saying you're perfect and they're imperfect. It's certainly not saying that you're better than the people in the world who are not here. There are many people in this world that are more consistent in their ethics and their behaviour than many of us here. It's not saying that. But it's saying the way of happiness is through true relationships with God and with one another. So that's an introduction to the Psalms. Enjoy reading them. Maybe reading different Psalms from different sections in the next few weeks. Maybe we'll use them as responsive prayers and songs in this service. Maybe we'll be singing songs that are modelled on the Psalms. Get used to them. Enjoy them. They're your hymn book, your prayer book, your celebration book. Let's finish with our final song then.